Does the universe exist if we're not looking? Well, perhaps it does, and perhaps it doesn't. It's like me. I am a very dynamic, powerful, outgoing, enjoyable person who just loves to be with all of you, and I love to be with everybody, but I like to solve problems. I get bored very quickly, I fall asleep, and to stay awake, I just invent my own problems and solve them. I like to solve problems. I get bored very quickly. I fall asleep. To stay awake, I just invent my own problems and solve them. Now, this is a cone. You know what a cone is? Mm-hmm. It's a conundrum. Mm-hmm. It's an unanswerable question. Does the universe exist if we're not looking? This is an article written by Tim Folger, in the Discovery magazine for June 2002. And it's written about a young kid who questions the universe. And he's been questioning the universe all of his 90 years. But he's just a young fellow. And these are some comments that he makes, and I find them extremely delightful. These are taken directly from the Discover magazine, so don't blame me for their purity and goodness. We inhabit a cosmos made real in part by our own observations. We inhabit a cosmos made real in part by our own observation. In other words, if we did not observe the cosmos, the earth, the planets, the stars, they would have no significance for being. That blow your mind for a start. Well, this fellow, what is his name? His name is John Wheeler. He's an eminent physicist, and he's at Massachusetts, at some place there, doing great things. And he is now still a professor, still going strong, and he says that what concerns him in his later years are ideas for ideas. Having ideas just for the sake of having ideas. And he concentrates, he said, I had a heart attack on January 9th, 2001, he says, and I said, that's a signal. I've only a limited amount of time left, so I'll concentrate on one question. Now, here's his question. How come existence? What brought existence into being? How come existence? Why does the universe exist? And of course, scientists, Nobel Prize winners and everything, all over the world are trying to figure this thing out. And they're not having too much luck at it. Now he comes up with these statements that I've highlighted here. The boundary between an objective world out there and our own subjective consciousness blurs in quantum mathematics. An atom and their innards, or the particles of light called photons, within an atom are photons, particles of light. What they see depends on how they have set up their experiment. What a scientist sees of the atom and the photons are how the scientists have set up an experiment. Now, he goes on to explain that the scientists think in waves or chunks or light or solid matter. They think in all these different terms. So, if they're going to be looking for something in solid matter, they'll have a certain type of instrumentation. If they're looking for waves of light or waves of energy, they'll have other detectors to detect it. And if they're looking for particles, they'll have still other detectors. Now, whatever they think it is, they're looking for, they will have the detector to look for it with that type of detector. Mm-hmm. A detector that detects particles, or detects light, or detects flow, that's what they have. So they are already creating that the end result of what they're doing
exactly.
by the instrument with which they're looking for the information. Mm-hmm. And so he went on to explain quite completely that if they have a particle of energy and they shoot it from the Earth to some distant galaxy, past other galaxies, this one particle of light, for instance, can travel this way and this way at the same time. The particle of light can be in two paths of the same light at the same time, or even more, if they want to get so courageous. But it can be seen in doing two things at the same time. And it seems impossible, but they set up a laboratory examination to see if this could be done, and it can be done. And so they took the same elements, same elemental objects, and they used it to send from one point to another, and they looked at something that was solid, something that was fluid, something that was a wave of energy, something that was light, and of course they had to have different instrumentation for each one. And with each different instrumentation, the light acted like they wanted it to act.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was how they detected it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as they're sending light particles out into space, looking for a return and looking for how it moves through the heavens, you know, they really have some sophisticated stuff. Whatever, it goes back to this one saint who said, the eyes that see God are the same eyes that God sees man with. You know? The eyes that God sees man with are the same eyes that man sees God with. Either way, it's both the same thing. So, in other words, with whatever technique they're looking at outer space, at the movement of space and existence, but we haven't come to the best part yet. That's even more exciting. You just wait. He goes on to say here, oh, this is how they describe him. This is a picture of him right down here. At 90.
Oh. He doesn't look like 90.
That guy there, down there. Mm-hmm. Well, that's him. Okay. And as a professor and as a teacher and as a man, they describe him a gentleman hidden inside of a gentleman.
Oh.
Now, isn't that quality? Mm-hmm. Ellen would like that, I'm sure.
I do.
Okay. Now, he says, the idea that the universe and the laws of physics are fine-tuned to permit the existence of life. He said, again, the idea that the universe and the laws of physics are fine-tuned to permit the existence of life. In other words, we have to take these laws that we're creating and fine-tune them to prove that we exist. Because otherwise we wouldn't know that we exist. And even that's not the greatest thing that he comes up with. For the past two decades, though, he has pursued a far more provocative idea for an idea, something he calls the genesis of observationship. Our observations, he suggests, might actually contribute to the creation of physical reality. What we see and what we think we see actually creates things being and happening. Quite a fascinating idea. To Wheeler, we are not simply bystanders on the cosmic stage. We are the shapers and creators living in a participatory universe. We are participating in the creation of our universe. We are participating in the development of the stars. We're participating in the Big Bang concept. We're participating in the black holes. We're participating in all of that. And as we think about it, we make it happen. But it's exciting. It's exciting. Wheeler's hunch is that the universe is built like an enormous feedback loop. a loop in which we contribute to the ongoing creation of not just the present and the future, but the past as well. To illustrate this idea, he devised what he calls a delayed choice experiment, which adds a startling cosmic variations to the cornerstone of quantum physics, the classic two-split experiment, which I explained to you. The light going two directions at once, and the same light, exactly the same light. And he points it out that the experiment is exceedingly strange in its own right, even without Wheeler's extra kink thrown in. It illustrates a key principle of quantum mechanics. Light has a dual nature. Sometimes light becomes like a compact particle, a photon. Sometimes it seems to behave like a wave spread out in space, just like the ripples in a pond. In the experiment, light, a stream of photons, shines through two parallel slits and hits a strip of photographic film behind the slits. The experiment can be run two ways, with photon detectors right beside each slit that allows physicists to observe the photons as they pass, or with detectors removed, which allows the photons to travel unobserved. When physicists use the photon detectors, the result is unsurprising, just what they expected. Every photon is observed to pass one split or the other. The photon, in other words, acts like particles. But when the photon detectors are removed, something weird occurs. One would expect to see two distinct clusters of dots on the film corresponding to where individual photons hit after randomly passing through one slot or the other. Instead, a pattern of alternating light and dark stripes appear. Such a pattern could be produced only if the photons are behaving like waves, with each individual photon spreading out and surging against both slits at once, like a breaker hitting a jetty. Alternatingly, bright stripes in the pattern of the film show where the crests from the waves overlap. Dark stripes indicate that the crest and a trough has canceled each other out. So these experiments are going on. And part of what he is explaining here, he says, observations in the present can affect how photons behaved in the past. Now, they're not saying yet what they will say. And what is that?
All time is now.
All time is now. They will say that because this is what they're saying here. Mm-hmm. Observations in the present can affect how a photon behaved in the past. In other words, it does, because all time is now. And I think this is quite a fascinating concept to be considering. And then he goes on here. Wheeler's thought experiment has been demonstrated in the laboratory in 1984, and it proved itself. Wheeler's conjecture that we are part of the universe that is a work in progress. We are part of a universe that is currently very active. And more on the universe is to come later, because they're saying, like his two hands here, one going up, one going down, the universes are flowing down this way and they're flowing up this way. There are universes upon universes upon universes, which is not unusual for us as metaphysicians. Mm-hmm. But here they're being proved and demonstrated. Wheeler conjectures we are part of a universe that is a work in progress. We are tiny patches of the entire of the universe looking at itself and building itself. It is not only the future that is still undetermined, but the past as well. And by peering back into time, even all the way back to the Big Bang, our present observations select one out of the many possible quantum histories for the universe. So in other words, the universe is having an infinite number of histories. You have a different history in the universe, and you, each one, we have a different history in the universe because we are selecting out of the past what we are, out of the present what we are, and out of the future what we are, which is all in the now. Mm-hmm. But until they recognize that it's all in the now, they'll still proclaim that. But science has been telling us that all time is now. So he goes on to say here, the object that transforms what might happen into what does happen. So the object transforms what might happen into what does happen when you bring forth the future in the present. The universe as a vast arena containing realms where the past is not yet fixed. Doesn't that sound strange? The past is not yet fixed. It seems unbelievable. It's a fascinating article. You'll enjoy reading it if you ever choose to. And it also blows your mind. The mystery of creation may not lie in the distant past, but in the living present, he proclaims. And I think he's entirely correct. And let's see. In the absence of observers, our universe is dead, said another current physicist. But in the quantum world, things are not always so straightforward. Whether the universe really existed before you started looking at it or not is an interesting question. Did the universe start, did it exist before you started looking at it? That's why I'm telling each one of you, you're the creator of your world. And I must stay away from creating it for you, because that's your adventure. And I do enough creating of your world for you, and encourage you to do it, but I must let you do it for yourself. His associate here, Linda, believes that conscious observers are an essential component of the universe and cannot be replaced by inanimate objects. The universe and the observer exist as a pair. In the absence of observers, our universe is dead. Quite a remarkable series of statements. But this is not the first physicist, quantum physicist, who comes up with these things. Edgar Mitchell was a physicist, and he was an astrophysicist, and he went up into outer space. And when he looked back down on the blue planet, and he thought to himself, oh my goodness, such a tiny little thing, I mean, it's like I can hold my hand. Of course, you go up on a mountaintop, and you look at or you go in an airplane, you look down at the little ants crawling along on the ground, and those are people, and cars, and stuff like that. But they look so tiny and so unimportant. And really, they are. Now, the next time you have an opportunity to fly, and you look down at humanity, just say to yourself, I am God, and I'm creating what I see down there. And look at the traffic lanes, if they're especially at a busy time, if you can see them. And they look very clogged. And then you can just speak your word, all is in divine order. And that group of traffic that you look at will all of a sudden start to flow perfectly, because you are objective. See, you're not down there being concerned in the traffic. You can be up here and the sky looking down and saying, all is in divine order, and you are objective about it, and so therefore you can be powerful. And I think that this was a wonderful possibility for us to play this type of game, because we can have great experiences by doing it. And when you do it, you will just enjoy yourself so much. Well, this information that I brought you today is from the Discovery Magazine for June, I believe we said. And yes, June 2002. And it's entitled, Does the Universe Exist If We Are Not Looking? And the answer, of course, is no.
No.
And that's quite charming, isn't it? Quite charming to say, no, the universe does not exist if we're not looking. And I think that's a lesson that we can all gain and learn from and enjoy. Well, thank you for letting me share this with you. And I'll repeat my little statement here from the beginning. I live in a very interesting world, but it's never fast enough for me. I have to slow down to be with you guys and work on the level that you're working on. And you sometimes bore me to hell, you know, and I fall asleep. And you think, oh, gee, he's just an old man, he's tired and stuff like that. And yeah, of course you're right. I like to solve problems. I like to get in there and work with you guys as you're working on your problem solving. But you're usually a moaning solving instead of problem solving. But I like to solve problems. I get bored very quickly. I fall asleep. To stay awake, I just invent my own problems and solve them. Thank you for spending this 20 minutes with me. I love you.